Welcome to the X-Cast X-Files Podwatch, episode 34, covering Pusher and Teso Dos Bichos. I'm your host, Darren Mooney, and with me today is Clara Cook. How are you, Clara?
I'm good, Darren. How are you?
I'm good. We've got a really interesting set of episodes, because I think the episodes that we're covering today sort of run the gamut from, like, one that many people will put in, like, their top 10, maybe top 20 X-Files episodes of all time, and maybe one episode that many people will put in their bottom 10, or maybe even 5 X-Files episodes of all time. Before we get to that, let's talk about the good one, which is Pusher. It is the 17th episode of the third season. It aired on February 23rd, 1996. It was written by Vince Gilligan. It was his first script as a writer on staff. He'd previously written Soft Light late in the second season as a freelance writer. He'd been offered a staff job. He hesitated to take it. Then when he took it, he had some difficulties getting his sort of script together in time. Pusher is the only script that Gilligan wrote for the third season. He became a lot more prolific in the later years, but it's a hell of a script. It's a fantastic episode, I think. What do you make of it, Clara?
I would agree with that. Yeah, it's a very good script. It's funny. There's some good twists to it. And it sort of encompasses this sort of terrifying idea, which is like the power of suggestion. And the power of suggestion is very strong. And in previous X-Files episodes, it's always been the government who's involved in influencing people. But this time it's a man who's a very interesting character, very complex, multi-dimensional character called Robert Modell.
Yeah, who is played by the actor Robert Wisden, who's a character actor who's popped up a couple of times. Obviously, he pops up again in the sequel episode Kitsunogiri in the fifth season. He popped up on Millennium under Glenn Morgan and James Wong. But he also, I think I probably know him best for playing Nixon in Zack Snyder's adaptation of Watchmen, where he did a sort of a somewhat questionable impersonation, but he's very, very good here. He's very, very good at capturing like the mundaneness of Robert Patrick Modell, the little man who dreamed that he was big, I think, is how Scully sort of describes him towards the end, or how Mulder describes him towards the end of the episode. He's a very banal sort of evil, isn't he?
Yeah, he's very mundane. He's this man who's failed at a lot of things in his life, and it's made him kind of angry and distrusting of other people. And then he gains this extraordinary ability, but yet doesn't really have the imagination to use it for good, I suppose, and uses it to hurt people. He has this like charisma about him, but it's all fake. It's all charisma that he's sort of borrowed and stolen from other sort of influences. He sort of claims he's a samurai, but it's all fake. I sort of felt like in the episode he fixates on Mulder because he sort of got the feeling he kind of admires Mulder. You know, Mulder is the G-man, is the FBI agent that he kind of wished he could have been. And because of that, he sort of fixates on him and decides to basically, not torture him, but, you know, he decides to test him with puzzles, basically. Yeah.
Sort of like turn into the Riddler. Because I think one of the things that's interesting about Modell is that he's, in many ways, like an archetypal Vince Gilligan character. In many ways, he actually resembles Walter White, the character that Gilligan will go on to create on Breaking Bad, in that he's a character who develops a fatal illness. In this case, it's a brain tumor. In Breaking Bad, it's lung cancer. But then what this person does, this person of thwarted ambition, who has failed to do anything exceptional or meaningful with their lives in some grand historic sense, uses this as an excuse to become something truly horrific, to engage in like this horrible, masculine, toxic, you know, sort of power fantasy. So, for example, you know, Walter White reinvents himself as Heisenberg, the drug dealer who provides the best crystal meth in the entire Southwest. Whereas, you know, Robert Patrick Modell describes himself as Usu, you know, Pusher. He becomes a problem solver who advertises an American Ronin. And you have this sort of this recurring theme in Gilligan's work of this idea of men who are sort of fixated on like the idea of what it means to be a man, but in the worst possible way. And it happens a bit with, say, Morris Fletcher, for example, who's a man of, later on of limited imagination, who uses something truly remarkable that happens to him, a body swap, to do something really mundane, like just cheat on his wife repeatedly. And I mean, in Pusher, there's this recurring sense that, like, Robert Modell almost imagines himself as a comic book supervillain. Like, he talks about training with Gurkhas in Nepal, and that's, like, that's Batman. He dreams of being Batman, basically. And even the bit where he's, like, ringing up Mulder and taunting him on the phone, that's, he's watched Dirty Harry once too often. And there's a sense, even when he fixates on Mulder, that he's playing into this idea that he's a really bad man who needs, like, he needs a nemesis to justify him. He needs an opponent worthy of him. He needs, like, Batman to the Riddler. He needs, sort of, like, Dirty Harry to the Killer Scorpio. And there's this sense that, like, Modell measures his worth by this. Because, as they point out at the end, he could have at any point treated the cancer that was pushing against his skull. He could have gone on and lived a life that was, it may be mundane, but obviously wouldn't have involved killing people for money. But he chose instead to use what happened to him as an excuse to just do something truly horrific. And I think, like, it happens even a bit when you see, like, Holly, the secretary who appears in the episode, who's Skinner's, who's been hit by a mugger, you know, when she was in Georgetown at the weekend. And you have Modell talk to her and say, basically, look, you know, I'd love to get a hold of the guy who did that to you. And it's just, it is this sense that Modell is really sort of tripping on this idea of what it is to be, like, a man, a really awful man, this violent, sort of horrible, like, leave a trail of bodies in your wake, like, have a game of wits involving, like, people's lives. Like, it's just, it's this image that's really uncanny and really uncomfortable. And it's just haunting. And Modell is, like, I would argue, one of the great X-Files villains, much like, say, Toombs, for example. Like, he's one of the characters who really sticks with me, even though I think maybe the sequel episode doesn't use him as well as Pusher does, because it's just such a great concept, such a great performance, and such a great execution of, like, an idea.
Yeah, they use the mundanity about him really well. Like, they emphasize it by putting him in really mundane situations, like the teaser where he's walking through a supermarket, or even when they actually break into his apartment, when they finally get a search warrant for his apartment, and how crappy and sort of boring his apartment is, even to his clothes, the way that the clothes that he wears, you know. And it sounds a bit silly, but I thought even the fact that he lured Mulder to a golf range, you know, just seems kind of so sort of like middle-aged, you know. It just seems like, oh, you know, that's not what you'd imagine a huge villain to be like, which is what makes him more and more scary.
It is indeed. And I mean, one of the things that really gets me about the golf scene is this guy has the capacity to make people do anything he wants with his voice. And what he does at the golf range is he uses it to make people listen to him, to make them pay attention to him. Like, that's his fantasy, is to be somebody worthy of being paid attention to. And in order to do that, he's willing to kill people and hurt people. And it's just, it's so pathetic in a way.
He's also very angry about the way that his life's turned out, I think. And Scully talks to Mulder about all the different, all the different things that he's attempted and failed at. So he's, you know, he tried to get to a certain level in the army and failed at that. And he tried to get into the FBI and he failed at that. And so I think, and she sort of talks about him being distrusting of authority, but yet kind of worshipping it as well. And I think one of the reasons why I thought he was such an angry person underneath it all was because of how cruel he is when he controls people. He allows people to still have an awareness of what they're doing. So you think of Collins being pushed into setting himself on fire, and Collins knows he's setting himself on fire, but he can't stop himself. Or Agent Burst being talked into having a heart attack over the phone, like knowing that that's actually what's happening to him, but he can't stop it. Or Holly, for instance, even beating up her boss and knowing she's beating up her boss, but she can't. She sort of says it was like I was looking at myself from a long way away, like he was in my head with me. There are some really nice touches in the episode, like some of the, like, so for instance, when Modell's right at the beginning in the teaser, when he's in the supermarket and he decides to pick up a newspaper, and on the front of it is the Flukeman, which I thought was really cool. And also as well, little bits like great quotes like Scully saying, you know, please explain the scientific nature of the whammy. Yeah, I mean, so there are some little funny details in there which make the episode, I don't know, it almost feels a little bit comedy like but then Modell is such a horrific character. It's such a terrifying idea that this individual could push you into doing something awful, and that you'd completely lose control of yourself, that it keeps the episode, I would say, as a monster of the week thriller type episode, even despite those comic touches, those wry sort of almost self-mocking touches. And I think the episode itself starts out like quite slow. I mean, I know obviously in the teaser there's a big dramatic car crash, but the pacing of it, the episode seems quite slow initially, and I think that's done for a reason, because it's almost like building to this crescendo at the very end, which is the last scene, which I'm sure we'll talk about, the last few scenes, the Russian roulette scene. But it's like the episode itself sort of pushes itself into you as well, if that makes sense, like pushes itself into your brain, and then you're kind of, by the end of it, you're
on the edge of the seat.
Yeah, you're like, oh my God, he's actually going to control Mulder, you know, like he's actually going to push Mulder into shooting Scully. It's very much an episode where, you know, it's a manhunt, there's clues, there's puzzles to follow, you know, it's very much a chase tempo, you know, it seems very, I don't know, I guess we'd say stereotypical of an X-File episode. But by the end of it, it actually becomes an episode about Mulder and Scully. Not even about Robert Modell, I would say. At the end of it becomes an episode about how they react together in a crisis, which at the beginning episode it's not about, despite the fact that Modell does say to Mulder over the phone, like, do you work well together? That's almost like a hint. Do you work well together? Because I'm going to test this. I'm going to test you guys as a team. But that's the only hint that you get right at the beginning of the episode, that the end of the episode will be about whether or not Mulder and Scully collectively could beat Robert Modell. And you get the feeling that the other law enforcement officers can't beat Modell because they aren't part of that team, you know? They aren't part of that core team.
One of the things I quite like about this is, and I don't know if it's just me, is there a sense that Mulder almost buys into the game that Modell's playing? The sense that, like, Mulder, as much as Modell is, like, trying to pitch himself as, like, a comic book supervillain with an arch-nemesis G-Man, like, there's a sense, I think, in the episode you get at points that Mulder is, like, he's obviously not thrilled that people are dying, but he's willing to go in and play along. Like, for example, when Modell says, bet you $5 I get off, Mulder gives him the $5, but obviously drops it on the ground and says, make you look. But you have this sense that, like, Mulder's willing to go in there knowing what Modell's capable of, and that puts him at the mercy of Modell. And it's only when Scully comes in at the end and Scully decides to break the rules by, you know, by shattering the, by setting off the alarm, breaking Mulder and Modell's concentration. Like, I think there's a sense watching the episode that Mulder almost on some level, maybe obviously not to the same extent that Modell does, that maybe part of him responds to, like, the romance of kind of Modell's, you know, fugitive and Mindhunter chasing one another in a police procedural. And, like, I think one of the clever twists at the end is that Scully arrives and sort of breaks that by just going, well, look, that's not what this story is. That's, you know, you have to sort of snap the two of them out of this, like, macho Russian roulette sort of one pull of a trigger each game they're playing.
I agree with you to a certain extent. I think that Mulder probably does think that he can just mentally deal with, like, Modell. And the point where the actual police officer who's like working with them, you know, the African-American police officer, who I don't think's ever given a name, but he does say, like, why are we giving Robert Modell what he wants? Like, why are we just giving this guy what he wants when Mulder goes in? And essentially that's what Mulder is doing. But I think Mulder thinks, I have the strength of mind. I understand what Modell's doing. I understand more than anyone because I figured it out and I can resist it. When he can't, you know, because nobody can. But I think he starts to realise that he made a mistake when Scully comes in and Modell makes him point the gun at her. I interpret it as he would rather shoot himself than shoot Scully, in the way that he puts the gun to his head, you know. I mean, he's wincing because he thinks the bullet might go out, leave the chamber, and he might end up shooting himself in the head. Yeah. But he's like, he doesn't shoot her right away. Like, he doesn't actually, I don't think he even clicks the...
No, he doesn't. The bullet's in there, so that when she sets the alarm, it's the next shot that hits Modell.
Yeah.
So if he had shot, he would have shot her.
So he is trying to resist her, you know. I mean, you don't actually see it in the shot, but there's been, like, publicity photos released afterwards of, like, them, you know, the scene and everything, and he's holding her arm and he has got this look of panic in his face. He doesn't want to yeah, shoot her. But I think by the fact that he's straining really hard, it gives her the time to go and pull the alarm. Her pulling the alarm is her saving him from having to shoot her. In a way, they kind of save each other a little bit. But yeah, I agree with you. I think Mulder went in there thinking, I mean, it's kind of crazy. Why did he... I mean, even when I was watching the episode the first time, when I was younger, I was like, why does he think he's going to be able to... What does he think he's going to be able to do? And there are other instances like this in the X-Files, but I guess you need the main characters in that situation, so you have to send them in, yeah, no matter what happens. But there are other instances in the X-Files where Mulder and Scully go into a situation without a clear plan. And you're like, how are you going to stop this ghost? Or how are you going to stop this monster? Or, like, what do you think you're... And I think maybe, as FBI agents...
You have to do this in the middle of the night, yeah.
Yeah, you have to do this in the middle of the night, yeah, exactly. Maybe as FBI agents with guns, they feel more invincible. But Robert Modell did kill a lot of law enforcement officers, so...
Yeah, I think that him going in there sort of half-cocked without a plan is maybe not the most on Mulder thing that he's done. I think that, like, when Skinner heard about that, he was like, yeah, I can kind of... There's you know, you don't... I have a form already filled out to report this. This is grand, you know?
But really, I do think that their strength lies in them as a team. And I think Robert Modell can't beat both of them. He could beat Mulder on his own, but he can't beat both of them. And that's the key, really.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Tezo Dos Bichos, the 18th episode of the third season, airing March 8th, 1996, directed by Kim Manners and written by John Shiban. Tezo Dos Bichos is famously known as the cat episode among certain members of the production team and certain members of the fandom. There are certain other less radio-friendly names that I would use to describe it. But so, Clara, what do you make of Tezo Dos Bichos?
It's a terrible episode. The script is bad. There are some funny moments, like Scully's line about labeling a partial rat body part as partial rat body part, which I thought was quite funny. But the script is bad. The story is bad. It's a story about a mummy, a possessed mummy, but the mummy itself doesn't do anything. Instead, the mummy
controls cats.
And you know, I'm a real cat fan, you know, and I understand that big cats like panthers or leopards can be frightening if you've found yourself in their company, but cats are just not frightening on television.
Also, they are impossible to direct as well, yeah. Which means the episode has to do lots of awful things like silhouette shots, and there's the really awful scene in the middle of the episode where they're attacked in the sewer, and Kim Manners, God bless Kim Manners, he tries. He really tries. And I think Gillian Anderson is allergic to cats as well, which may have compounded the issue. But there's scenes where Scully is attacked, so you have like a quick flash of her face. You have a quick flash of like what's supposed to be the paw of a cat, but looks like something on like a lollipop stick. Then you've got a quick cut of her reacting to that. Another cut of the cat of the paw coming in. And it looks like a film student trying to recreate Psycho with a house cat. And it just doesn't work at all. It's horrible. And it goes on and on and on. And the episode is full of little moments like that where, like, I think Manners has talked about, like, directing cats was impossible because they would never do what they were supposed to do. Because cats are not like herd animals and cats are not like dogs. They're not animals that you can train easily to do things on command. So when you turn the camera on them, you just hope they do something that looks threatening. And most of the time, they don't.
It suffers because I don't know whether, and I don't think this is Kim Manners' fault, but I think David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson were just not buying into this script. I don't think they were buying into this episode. I think part of it was, like you say, that Gillian Anderson had to be attacked by fake cat arms because she's allergic to cats. But also, their acting is just pretty bad in this episode. I think they were just not impressed by the script. I think everybody involved knew it was a bit of a stupid story, and so everybody's trying their best, but they're not really hitting the mark. And the main character, who's like the main, I would say, what, the main villain? I don't know if he's a villain so much, but he's one of the main protagonists.
Dr. Luton, is it?
I was about to say Dr. Alonzo Bilac, Vic Trevino. I don't know what was going on with that actor or how he was directed, but his performance is just so, I mean, he's supposed to be,
his accent in particular and his sort of like his mannerisms.
He's supposed to be under the influence of a drug, right? But he took that too far. I mean, it's like a wooden performance. It's like Mulder and Scully are talking to a plank of wood, and he's so out of it that even to the point where right at the beginning of the episode when they first meet him, it's just so obviously, you know, up to no good. He's obviously up to nefarious deeds, you know? I mean,
yeah, he might as well have a little tag around his neck going, look, I am close to this episode's antagonist.
Yeah.
You know, I'm close to the anthropomorphic personification of this episode's antagonist as you're going to get. It's just so lifeless and lethargic. Like, the problem with it is not that it's awful in the way that, say, you know, Badla is awful, or even El Mundo Giro, to pick on John Shaban scripts. I feel kind of bad picking on John Shaban scripts, but quite a lot of them are terrible. But I think that with Tezo Dos Bichos, there's just a sense that, like, everybody just wants to go home at the end of the week. And I mean, like, even stuff like, on paper, it's kind of interesting because you've got this stuff about, like, cultural appropriation and, like, we're not stealing it, we're saving it. You've got, like, the chief archaeologist being named Roosevelt, as if to suggest Teddy Roosevelt. You have the obvious homage to cat people with the naming of Dr. Luton. But it's so lifeless. It's so dull and dreary and boring, and it is a chore to sit through.
And the scariest thing about it, I think, is actually the mummy itself, like in the big urn. I thought that image was actually quite frightening. The idea of there being a curse and this being like a female mummy, you know, maybe this was some sort of priestess at one point. I actually thought that was actually kind of not a bad idea. Even if somebody could, I don't know, if the mummy could appear to people in visions or something, it's just, it's hard to link the person in the grave with the cat that's walking around. The two seem very uninterconnected, you sort of saying, until later in the episode when they're trying to explain it to you.
And even then, you have that sort of weird thing where the X-Files does it quite a bit in the early seasons, where you have, like, those scary foreigners, which is really uncomfortable to watch, like, where you have, like, this guy at the end, the sort of chieftain who has, like, jaguar eyes, for example. There's this weird sense of, like, this fear of something that's foreign.
Yeah, I mean, it's insulting, really, isn't it? I mean, but also the music really bothered me.
Yes, the Mark Snow, the ethnic chimes of doom.
The idea that, I mean, it's not impossible, actually, that people would be playing wind instruments in Ecuador. But, I mean, do you know what I mean? It's just...
It's the shorthand of it. It's the fact that you're meant to hear it and think that it's inherently scary, which is kind of worrying of itself.
It's not discriminative, but it's walking a fine line, shall we say.
Oh, no. It's not as bad as Teleco or El Mundo Giro. No. Like, to be clear on this, like, it is offensive, but it's offensive in, like, a background kind of way. In that, like, you get a sense that when they were writing it, they were thinking, this is so right on, because this is about, like, how we shouldn't take the national treasures of foreign countries and put them in museums. That's a form of imperialism, and that's bad. And so I think that this episode, you know, you get a sense that when they were writing it, there was a sense that they're like, yeah, this is a good episode. This is something that we are saying that is important. But the way that they do it is so cliche and so trite and so condescending that it just sort of sabotages itself, almost. Famously, the title is also a euphemism for testicles as well, which Shaban didn't realise at the time, apparently.
What was he trying to say?
It's a burial mound of small animals, but the word bichos is a euphemism for testicles in Colombia and Venezuela.
I've also read online that the people wearing the indigenous people wearing the hats in the first scenes are wearing hats that the Sequoia, which they talk about, you know, the tribe from Ecuador, wouldn't actually wear, because the Sequoia come from the tropical Amazon region of Ecuador, so they wouldn't be wearing knitted hats.
This is an example of how tone deaf it is, but I think we've talked about it enough, probably. Is there anything else that you'd like to grab or like to talk about or draw attention to with regards to Death of Those Beatrice?
No, I think we've covered it. That was it.
All right. Where can we find you online, Clara, if we want to check you out?
Okay, so you can find me on Twitter at Clara Jean. That's Clara, C-L-A-R-A, and Jean, J-E-A-N-M-C.
Perfect. You can follow me at Darren_Mooney. I have a book coming out around maybe the time that this is being released, which is Opening the X-Files, A Critical History of the Original Series. It's available from Amazon, or where all good books are sold. It's hopefully fun, hopefully interesting. But anyway, in the meantime, you can follow the show at @X_cast. You can find us at our own Facebook page. You can join us in our group, the XCast X-Files Podcast Fan Group, for lots of discussion and debate. You can also just tweet at us as well. Myself and Clara would love to hear your opinions on the episodes that we talked about today, so feel free to just hit us up and let us know what you thought. Tomorrow is episode 35, which will be covering Hell Money and Jose Chung's From Outer Space, which are two very interesting episodes. I think I'm actually quite looking forward to hearing Zach and Tanya's take on those myself. But until the next time, trust no one.